right. Well, good morning again.
All right. The Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Judge Johnson, Judge Riley, Honorable Judge Jeffrey M. Brian presiding. Case number A-19-1805, Community Finance Group, Inc., Appellant versus Main Street Ostego LLC, Respondent, Landcore Companies, Inc., Respondent, Robert L. Fields, Respondent, Patricia Fields, Respondent, ABP, LLC, et al. Respondents.
So we were just in the middle of making sure everybody's technology was working when I ended up having problems. Can everybody hear me okay? Great. And Judge Riley will be participating, but she has turned off her video to reduce the likelihood that there's a connectivity issue. Judge Riley, are you able to hear everything?
I can hear everything. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. And Judge Johnson.
I can see and hear everything, and I will stay in this mode unless I believe that I should go to audio only.
Mr. Anderson.
Good morning, Your Honor. Are you able to hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. There was a delay and some static on my end when you were talking. So hopefully that's something that was momentary. Let's see. Mr. Steinhoff, are you able to hear and see everything?
Yes, Your Honor, I can hear and see everything.
Great. And Mr. Porter?
Yes, Your Honor, I can hear and see everything.
All right. And as far as respondents' time division goes, my understanding is that one of you will be speaking for 10 minutes and the other for 5. Have you decided? Is that correct? And which one of you will be doing which part of it?
Your Honor, I'll be speaking first for 10 minutes, and then Mr. Porter will be speaking for 5 minutes.
And that's okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Steinhoff. And I will ask that before the judges jump in, if we can say our name so that Judge Riley, who might not be able to see us, will at least know who's talking. And Mr. Anderson, Mr. Steinhoff, and Mr. Porter, as we have these conversations, it might be helpful for you when you start talking to say who you are again. And the only other thing I will mention is because of the number of us, the marshal's viewpoint, the screen for the marshal should have a clock on it. But if you're not able to see that, sometimes you have to switch the toggle the view in WebEx from the active speaker mode to this grid view. And then if you're in the grid view, you'll see all of us at the same time. And that way you'll be sure to see the clock. You should see it now. Ticking down. So if you can't see it, then you might have to adjust that. Mr. Anderson, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. You may begin.
Thank you. Justices, judges of the Court of Appeals, and may it please the court. My name is Jordan Anderson. I am the attorney representing the plaintiff in this case, Community Finance Group, Inc., which is a Minnesota limited liability company. This case has been, I believe, thoroughly briefed. And so I will start with the issue of law that I think is the three issues of law that I think are the most important in this case. The first is the pleading standard. In this case, the pleading standard is and must be held to the strict notice pleading standard that's identified in Walsh, which is cited in our brief as well, and which incorporates the pleading standard from decades ago, and reiterates that the notice pleading standard requires a plaintiff to only plead the sufficient information in order to put the responding party or the defending party on notice of the legal theory upon which the case is intended to proceed. In that case, the entire argument rests because the notice pleading standard was not applied on any of the counts that were dismissed by the lower court.
Mr. Anderson, it seems to me that, I think there's three substantive issues, the first two being res judicata and the contractual releases, both of which I believe are essentially defenses by the defendants. But, I mean, the issue about whether we look to Rule 8 or Rule 9, that has no application to the defenses of res judicata and release, does it?
It has the application in as much as the court in the lower court accepted matters that are outside of the notice pleading and outside of the complaint for purposes of the application of the res judicata and for purposes of the application of the purported releases. And when the court considered those issues or considered those matters, which were only partially placed before the lower court, the court determined that the factual allegations raised by the defendants were in fact dispositive of the case and ignored or disregarded the affirmative factual allegations that were actually made by the plaintiff. And so in doing that, the lower court erroneously converted the matter to a summary judgment argument or a summary judgment motion and ruled on the summary judgment standard because the court relied on pleadings and documents that were outside of the pleadings.
Mr. Anderson, this is Judge Riley. I just want to make sure that I understand the factual background. So I'm going to tell you what I understand, and would you please correct me if I'm wrong in any way? So this matter started out with your client giving an unsecured loan in November of 06 to Robert. I'll just use first names. Is that right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
And he signed a promise.
I'm sorry. I believe that the unsecured loan was made in November of 2008, Your Honor.
08, okay. And then he used that money for the holiday station to improve that. And then there's a bankruptcy. And there was an adversary proceeding in that bankruptcy. Well, first, your client got a default judgment against Robert. And then there's the adversary proceeding and the bankruptcy proceeding. And the bankruptcy judgment against him individually was for, I'll just say, $750,000 plus interest. And is that right?
Well, it's not inaccurate, but it is it needs a bit of explanation. The default judgment that was obtained against defendants Main Street Otsego LLC and Landcore Companies, Inc. That's because the loan that was made in this case was not directly to Mr. Fields. The loan that was made to those defendants, Main Street Otsego and Landcore. And the loan that was made to those companies was used by Mr. Fields, Robert Fields, to enrich ABP rather than to perform the work that was intended to be performed with those monies. And so the finances that that were given to the initial defendants in the first case that was granted the default did not go to enrich Main Street Otsego or Landcore. They went to enrich the holding of ABP LLC.
Okay, but then the bankruptcy judgment in the adversary proceeding, there were three. One of them was against Robert individually.
In the bankruptcy proceeding that was subsequent to that, my client Community Finance Group LLC proceeded with an adversary claim to exclude from discharge the personal obligation for the loans on Main Street Otsego and Landcorp, which were defaulted on the grounds that Mr. Robert Fields had personally engaged in that activity, solicited the funds on behalf of these other companies, and that he had done so by misrepresenting the financial holdings of Main Street Otsego and Landcorp. Specifically, he represented that Main Street Otsego or Landcorp held what in fact ABP held. And my client was not aware of the final destination of the funds at that time, and that finding wasn't concluded by the adversary proceeding.
So what do you think that $750,000 judgment involved in that adversary proceeding?
The $750,000 judgment was the loan amount, which was $500,000, to Main Street Otsego Landcorp companies, that my client made the loan based on misrepresented evidence or information by Robert Fields on behalf of those companies as to the holdings and assets and value of those companies. And because of those misrepresentations to my client, Robert Fields was found to be personally responsible for the loan plus the interest and the costs or penalties. And by the time that the judgment was entered, Your Honor, it was the $750,000 plus additional interest, which wasn't identified or clearly articulated. But that judgment is the judgment that judgment is to hold Mr. Robert Fields personally responsible for what he did to deceive my client in obtaining the loan in the first place.
So you now have a judgment against him for that nefarious behavior, as you would, or fraudulent behavior, however you would characterize it. And so then the $1.3 million that you're now seeking in this lawsuit is that judgment plus the interest that's accrued, the contractual interest of 14%, is that right?
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Okay, I just needed to understand the 1.3, and I think I do now. Thank you.
Mr. Anderson, you, the Honor. District Court concluded that you had not stated a claim for relief on some counts because you did not allege that a transfer was made by the debtor of debtor's property. I think I'm describing that correctly. But was it your intent to prove that voidable transfers were made with respect only to the debt of Mr. Fields, or were there other debts that were the subject of your claims?
Thank you, Your Honor. That's a good point of clarification. My client's position is that the various transfers, transactions, which my client is proceeding on, are in pursuit of only the underlying judgment. There are no other transactions between my client and any of the defendants upon which we seek relief.
Just a minute. I want to make sure that Mr. Steinhoff is still with us. I see that his video screen has gone blank. Mr. Steinhoff, are you able to hear us?
Your Honor, I can hear you. I can see you. I can see myself, but I see I'm frozen, so my video isn't working. But if you can hear me, my audio is working.
Okay. Well, we'll proceed then with you participating only by audio for the moment. I just wanted to make sure that you could still hear the questions and the answers. I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Anderson. Did you finish your answer?
I believe I did.
Yeah, Mr. Anderson, to repeat the gist of your answer? I actually didn't hear part of it due to a little glitch.
Thank you. The The answer was simply that my client doesn't have any other transactions or relationships directly with any of the defendants other than the underlying loan and judgment that resulted from the loan. And I believe that your question was whether or not there were other other transactions between the parties upon which my client was suing other than the judgment. Did I understand the question correctly?
Well, which judgment are you referring to?
So there was a default judgment in Minnesota State District Court against Landcor, which was the judgment that was not
really. I understand. There's a Hennepin County default judgment. There also was a bankruptcy court judgment, and I'm not sure which one you're referring to. To both or just?
They are the same, Your Honor. The Hennepin County judgment was the judgment that was exempted in the adversary proceeding. So the Hennepin County judgment was held to be the responsibility of Robert Fields personally in the adversary proceeding, but there are no, it's not too different. They don't add together. They're the same underlying transaction that was the responsibility of Robert Fields through the adversary proceeding and
One more question about this. I don't want to dwell on it too long, but so that the Hennepin County default judgment was against Main Street and Landcor. Those two entities were not parties to the personal bankruptcy action. Did the bankruptcy court somehow discharge that judgment or consider it? I kind of assumed that. I understand that both of these judgments represent the same harms, or you know that they're overlapping in a sense. But I did not understand previously that the Hennepin County default judgment ceased to exist at some point.
I don't believe that the Hennepin County default judgment ceased to exist. However, I believe that it would be inappropriate to double recover if we were able to recover the adversary judgment. It would include the recovery for the prior judgment. They're the same obligation. They are several between those two companies and Mr. Robert Fields personally. But they are not able to be stacked together or recovered for both of them. So the district court, I'm sorry, the bankruptcy court did not discharge the judgment against Landcor or Otsego. The bankruptcy court adversary proceeding did not permit Mr. Robert Fields to discharge that obligation. Which he was, I believe, we held him personally responsible for that obligation. Have I answered your question, Judge? Okay, so but these are good questions because these are issues of fact that need to be fleshed out in this current case. But more specifically, the effect of the discharge of the remaining obligations of Robert Fields, subject to my client's adversary judgment in that case, does not mean that my client has no avenue except for the personal assets actually in my client's possession to go and collect that judgment. My client did not know about the transfers, the way that Mr. Fields had hidden these assets or transferred them to his children. The complaint affirmatively alleges that his children knew that the assets were being transferred or assisted him in keeping the assets away from my client for judgment. And the settlement that was reached with the trustee in the primary bankruptcy case, not my client's adversary case, those settlements were based on false information about the value of ABP. So by accepting $150,000 in exchange for the debtors, Robert Fields and Patricia Fields' position or ownership interest in ABP, the trustee accepted money or accepted far less than the actual fair value of those shares and made no effort to undo the transfer of ownership of ABP that had been done.
Mr. Anderson, I see that your time has expired, and I think you'll have some time on rebuttal to finish your thoughts. And maybe when you do that, you can address this a little more fully, and specifically the respondent's argument that that's something that you should bring before the bankruptcy court. So maybe that's something you can address when you come back before us on rebuttal. Mr. Steinhoff.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And let me, before you begin, you're still able to see the clock?
Yes, sir. I can see the clock and I can see you. I can hear you. My video is still frozen, but I'll proceed with your permission.
Go ahead.
May I please the court? I represent five of the respondents, ABP, LLC, Progeny Group, LLC, and then Alexander, Benjamin, and Patrick Fields, who are the adult children of the debtor, Robert Fields.
I'm sorry to interrupt again. I just want to make sure Mr. Anderson looks like he's put his video, he turned his video off. I just want to make sure that that's the case, that he can still hear us. Mr. Anderson?
Thank you, Your Honor. I can still hear everybody. I turned my video off.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Steinhoff. And now that I see it's now, it's been about a minute since we, and you haven't yet started, so we'll take that into consideration and make sure you have a full 10 minutes here. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. And I'll start briefly with the pleading standard. And I agree with Judge Johnson that it's really not pertinent here. You can construe the pleading in favor of the plaintiff as much as you want, but the respondents here have legal defenses that are categorical, and it doesn't matter how you construe the facts in the complaint. Eventually, you're going to run into one of the three legal defenses that we've asserted, the first of which is the preclusive effect of the adjudications in the prior adversary proceedings and the settlements that were reached by the trustee. The second is the one that was just discussed, subject matter jurisdiction, to the extent that the appellant is trying to undo transactions that were made by a U.S. trustee and approved by the bankruptcy court. And third is the fact that most of these transfers that are described in the complaint, and certainly all of them that date after the bankruptcy, they just aren't voidable transfers or fraudulent transfers as defined by the statute, because they aren't transfers of the debtor's property that were made by the debtor. It was other entities or people's assets that went to the debtor or to other people, but they just aren't voidable or fraudulent transfers.
On that point, I do want to make sure I understand, and if this was something that Mr. Porter was going to address, I can wait until his turn. But if this is something you plan to address, then when it comes to the failure to state a claim under the transfer statute because of the definition of the terms used in the statute, on that piece of it, did the district court look to anything outside of the facts that were contained in the pleading to conclude that the complaint was insufficient, or did it only concern itself with what was pled?
Your Honor, as to that theory, that defense, the district court only looked at the pleading. If you read the amended complaint, and you read the description of the transfers that happened after the bankruptcy settlements, all of them, or none of them, I guess I should say, involve assets of the debtor or transfers that were made by the debtor. And it's not necessary to look at anything beyond what the words on the amended complaint, and the district court didn't.
And if I could follow up, does it matter whether or not you're using the Rule 9 or the Rule 8 standard for purposes of looking at the facts that were pled and deciding if those facts describe a transaction that would meet the definition of the statute?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it would be proper to dismiss them under either standard. I think the claims describe transfers, and those transfers just aren't voidable or fraudulent under the statute, to the extent that they had to be pled with particularity under Rule 9.2. I think they were pled with particularity, but as pled with particularity, they just aren't voidable transfers. And if you consider,
do I understand from your brief that you believe that we are reviewing a Rule 12 motion to dismiss, not a Rule 56 motion for summary judgment?
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe that's correct. As to the other defenses, res judicata and perhaps subject matter jurisdiction, the district court did consider documents outside the pleadings, but those are documents that the court was allowed to consider in the context of a Rule 12 motion to dismiss. There's a number of cases from this court which have looked at this issue in the context of res judicata or collateral estoppel or collateral attack, or there was one case, Rorick, which involved a malpractice case, not a defense of that sort.
Okay, Mr. Steinhoff, I want to move quickly to make good use of our time. So the judgment that was obtained in the bankruptcy court in the adversary proceeding was dated, I think, November of 2013. It seems like the district court's application of res judicata in this case would effectively preclude anyone who obtains such a judgment in an adversary proceeding in a bankruptcy court from ever doing any kind of post-judgment discovery or any other kinds of collection remedies if we were to sustain the district court's res judicata ruling. What's your general response to that?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. What the appellant is precluded from doing is bringing specific kinds of claims against two of my clients, ABP, LLC, and Alexander Fields, based on releases and dismissals that were resulted from adversary proceedings brought against those two of my clients by the trustee in the underlying bankruptcy. So
perhaps my question is better, maybe my question is better suited for Mr. Porter, given that, but I guess are you relying at all on any preclusive effect of the adversary proceeding CFG versus Robert Fields?
No, Your Honor, I'm not. There's nothing that stops appellant from collecting from Mr. Fields. There's nothing that stops appellant from chasing those assets, collecting those assets. What he can't do is, what it can't do is bring a fraudulent transfer claim against my clients, because those claims were already brought and they were adjudicated, and my clients have been released from them. Oops.
Well, with respect to the release, the settlement agreement containing the release was signed by the trustee and by ABP, I believe. ABP was a party to the release, but CFG was not a party to the contractual release. I mean, isn't that necessary? But for the operation of a contractual release, the plaintiff whose claims are barred by the release has to be a party to the contract?
Now, Your Honor, the core of our defense here is that the trustee was acting as the fiduciary representative of unsecured creditors of the bankruptcy estate, which included appellant. So the trustee is in privity, was in privity with appellant and every other unsecured creditor bankruptcy estate. So actions
not
taken
privity in the res judicata sense, but privity in a contractual sense. And do you have authorities in your brief on that point?
No, Your Honor. I mean the releases and the settlements were how the underlying claim was adjudicated. So I think it's proper to consider them as part of res judicata, not as a separate contract-based theory. And that's how it's presented in the briefs. I don't see, as a matter of contract law, I think the settlement agreements and the releases would bind appellant separate from res judicata, but as it was briefed and argued before the district court, it was kind of a package deal. The releases were pertinent to the res judicata defense, not a separate contract-based defense. And I see my time is up.
Judge Bryan, I'm wondering if the court would allow a couple more questions.
Please go ahead.
Isn't one of the requirements of the res judicata doctrine that there be a final judgment on the merits?
Correct, Your Honor, but there is case law that settlement agreements constitute a final adjudication on the merits for purposes of res judicata.
Have you cited that case law in your brief?
That is cited in my first brief, Your Honor.
And do you remember the case name?
I don't remember it off the top of my head, Your Honor. I might be able to find it really quick.
Okay, we can find it. So, and I guess my other question has to do with respect to res judicata has to do with the issue of privity. I guess, isn't the trustee, I mean, is in essentially sort of standing in the shoes of the debtor? I know the trustee is trying to represent the collective interests of all unsecured creditors, but as a group, not individually. And my basic understanding is that a trustee is trying to be acting as a prudent debtor would in conserving the assets and maximizing the assets of the bankrupt estate for the sake of maximum distribution to creditors. But I just don't quite understand. I know you cited one case from another jurisdiction, but I just am having a hard time understanding how there could be privity between the trustee and CFG in these circumstances. Could you please explain that reasoning?
Your Honor, the trustee does not represent the debtor. It steps into the shoes of the debtor, but it represents the interests of the estate and the creditors of the estate. And in my brief, there's a case, an Eighth Circuit case, Nagley, In Re Nagley, I think it's called, that endorses that principle. And there's cases in other jurisdictions that specifically say that for purposes of res judicata, the trustee is in privity with unsecured creditors of the estate, not necessarily secured creditors, but unsecured creditors. And I don't see how bankruptcy could work if that weren't the case. What would be the point of having the trustee bring these preference actions or fraudulent transfer actions against parties like my client if the results weren't binding on individual unsecured creditors like appellant? Why would my clients ever sign a settlement agreement with a trustee if some random unsecured creditor could just sue it for the exact same thing after the bankruptcy estate is closed. So I think it's a pretty, I'm not a bankruptcy lawyer, but my perception based on everything I've researched and read is it's a pretty universally accepted principle that at least as to unsecured creditors, the trustee is in privity with and binds people within the unsecured creditor pool for purposes of settlement agreements and res judicata and actions taken by the trustee for the estate. I hope that answers your question, and I'll pass the baton to Mr. Porter with your permission.
All right, go ahead, Mr. Porter.
Thank you, Your Honors, to my colleagues, and thank you, Mr. Steinhoff. May it please the court, if I will pick up right on the discussion we were having, unless Your Honors feel satisfied with Mr. Steinhoff's answer, I will basically be echoing what he concluded with. The reality is if we required contractual privity between a trustee and each and every creditor in these bankruptcy cases, which, you know, sometimes have hundreds of creditors, it will have the natural effect of unraveling the very purpose of bankruptcy. It's not tenable, it's not feasible. But I think just as importantly in this particular case is the fact that the trustee sued out an adversary proceeding against ABP. And the claims were related to fraud. Also, the appellant in this case sued Mr. Fields in an adversary proceeding for fraud. I think that adversary proceeding was commenced in 2010, May of 2010, that's correct. And we didn't have a judgment until 2013. What that says to me is there was extensive discovery done and they had every opportunity to find out these issues if there were indeed issues to discover. Maybe that happened, maybe it didn't, but that's when we have a settlement by the trustee, we have adversary proceedings by the bankruptcy court, and we have a final adjudication, which includes both the adversary proceedings against Mr. Fields and the adversary proceeding against ABP via a settlement which is approved by the bankruptcy judge. What this culminates to is a situation where we have to have res judicata step in. We have to have these settlements mean something. And that's the what we have here. Now, I represent Robert Fields, who has now an adversary judgment, or adversary proceeding judgment against him in the neighborhood of $750,000 plus interest, which gets us to around $1.4 million. My thought here was to focus on two issues. I think Mr. Steinhoff briefed and addressed a lot of much of what should be addressed, but I was going to focus my arguments on the issue of whether or not the court improperly considered extrinsic evidence, as appellant calls it, and this misapplication of the law. Given the limited amount of time I have, I would just throw out there, if the judges have questions, I'd rather focus on those than what I think is important.
Am I correct, Mr. Porter, that your brief states that you think this court should apply a Rule 12 standard on appeal?
I do. I do note and recall that my brief does make a very brief mention of the Rule 56 standard. And my only intent there was to say, even if we did apply that standard, the court would still be inclined to dismiss. The Rule 12 standard is a higher standard to meet. So if we can't even, if we're dismissing at that Rule 12 standard, then we certainly can dismiss at the Rule 56 or with the Rule 56 standard. So I guess,
Mr. Porter, is it your position that, we have the general principle that you can't look beyond the pleadings, and then there are exceptions to that principle. And I'm wondering what your position is about any time one of those exceptions might apply, whether it's res judicata claims or some other type of claims. Do you believe that the district court then has to convert, or I shouldn't say convert, I don't think that's the words used in the rule, but has to treat that motion as if it were a summary judgment motion, or can they still treat it like a motion to dismiss, even though they're in one of those exceptions?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it depends on the nature of the facts that are being presented to the district court. In this case, I think the court properly kept it within the purview of Rule 12 motion. The reason is the evidence that was presented outside the complaint is all based off of and from pleadings from previously adjudicated matters. Pleadings that we should all make sure to recognize the plaintiff relies on in his complaint. I make mention of this in my brief. It seems, I don't want to say hypocritical, but it's odd, I think, that the plaintiff or appellant in this case will point to the bankruptcy judgment and say, this is why I need relief. But then in the same vein, but judge, you can't go look at the pleadings. I'm sorry, Your Honor, go ahead.
No, I understand. I want to ask one more question as your time dwindles here. The cases that are cited in respondents' briefs that show that a district court can look to bankruptcy pleadings to address a res judicata defense, I didn't see in those cases a clear characterization of whether or not the district court then was treating that as a summary judgment motion or was treating it somehow still as a motion to dismiss with the ability to look at pleadings as if they had been attached to the complaint, for example.
I think it's necessary for the district court to have to be able to do that, especially in the context of res judicata, Your Honor. The reason is, I mean, res judicata, by its very definition, relies on the fact that there's this previous adjudication, wherever it comes from. In this case, it happened to come from a bankruptcy court. That we don't have a specific case that points to, you know, this exact situation that allows the district court to look to a quote-unquote bankruptcy pleading, I think is it doesn't matter, because it's still we're still using the same general rule, or excuse me, the same general exception to the rule that we can look to these preceding pleadings, the previous pleadings that give rise to the res judicata claim. I mean, if we can't do that, it as I said in my complaint, it completely unravels the res judicata defense if you can't point to the pleadings in the previous action. Did I answer your question, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson, rebuttal.
Thank you, gentlemen. Can you see me okay? Okay. This court has determined in the case Forster v. Thies, it's 906 Northwest 2nd, 846, that a trustee has the authority to adjudicate claims and has the ownership of the claims of an unsecured debtor during the pendency of the bankruptcy. But this court held that at the conclusion of the bankruptcy, the trustee's authority is terminated, and the claims, to the extent that they exist after the bankruptcy, return to the plaintiff. These claims that are made here in this case are not owned by the bankruptcy trustee or by the bankruptcy estate. They are and remain my client's claims.
Mr. Anderson, there was no argument. There was no res judicata argument in that case, correct?
There was a res judicata argument in that case, Your Honor. They described it as a standing or as a subject matter jurisdiction, but the application that they were looking for and the application that this court rejected was was whether or not the party had a live claim that belonged to themselves. I believe that
I think I understand that, but I mean, I don't see any mention of res judicata. I don't see that the court analyzed the three or four requirements of the res judicata doctrine. It seems like the defendants or debtors in that case simply did not assert that defense. Do you disagree with that?
I believe that I briefed it, but I'm not sure exactly which page it's on. My understanding was that the Forster v. Thies case was the one where the court, maybe it was the Sunrise case. I'm sorry. It's briefed in in my brief, Your Honor.
Brief. Okay.
Okay.
I think
the issue
you can move on.
The re judicata. Thank you. But the main issue is these claims that my client is making right now are that Robert Fields intentionally divested himself of his interest in ABP while putting all of his assets into ABP with the express purpose of avoiding having to pay back my client or other debtors or other creditors prior to declaring bankruptcy. That's the pleading. That pleading is not unclear, and that is the affirmative pleading that's made against Robert Fields in this case, which is pled at the Rule 9 level because it's required to be pled at the Rule 9 level. But that knowledge, that information wasn't in my client's possession, wasn't available to my client, and it wasn't in the trustee's possession, and it wasn't available to the trustee. So those claims were not, they had not, those claims didn't exist at that time because the claim doesn't exist until it's known or should have reasonably been known. Mr. Porter's argument about how the duration of the trial or the duration between the beginning and the end of the case indicates to him that there was discovery and my client knew or should have known. These are fact issues. If that's an argument that can prevent my client from seeking relief in this case, it has to be at summary judgment when he can prove what my client knew or should have known. The fact that those claims, the claims in this case, didn't exist at that time is the way that they were pleaded and means that my client is entitled to pursue those now under the Thies case or Forster v. Thies. So I wanted to make sure that was clear. The other thing is with the definition of the statute. The statute has been interpreted for over a century, and the foundational issue on a fraudulent transfer claim has always been that the statute needs to be interpreted broadly in order to provide remedy to the person who has been the victim of the fraudulent transfer, in order to provide relief for the person and in order to prevent the kind of situation that happens here. Mr. Fields transferred $9 million worth of assets into his children's name, and his children paid $150,000 for those assets. And that's the exact purpose of the statute for avoiding that transfer. I see my time is concluded. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to entertain them, but I don't want to press on.
I don't have any. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much to counsel for their briefs and for their arguments today. We appreciate them. We will be issuing an opinion within the statutory deadline, and the case is now under advisement.